Australian True Crime. The live show is coming.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which this podcast is recorded. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and to Aboriginal elders emerging.
Hey, don't fast forward yet because I got to tell you that we're doing another YouTube Live this weekend, but it's 8 p.m. Saturday night. 8 p.m. Saturday night. What was I thinking? Trying 6 p.m. Sunday night. That is Mum Armageddon. I don't know why I thought that was a good idea. All hell broke loose at my place after I tried that last week. Firstly, I couldn't get it going because I was so stressed about dinner, I think, and there was a lot of drama happening. But it's definitely going to start on time this week. Don't worry, I've got someone to help me. And this is just a better time, I think. 8 p.m. Saturday night, sadly, is peak doing nothing else time for me. In my life, so hopefully it is for you too. Why not talk crime? Let's get on YouTube. That's where we'll be. Hopefully Emily will be there as well. It's very technologically advanced this week. It's going to blow your mind. So 8 p.m. Saturday night on our YouTube channel, that's Australian True Crime Podcast on YouTube, we'll be chatting. You can chat back. We'll be talking all things true crime. It's amazing. I hope you can come. Also, if you're not a patron yet and you would like to hear a bonus episode featuring court reporter Jamel Wells, then seriously, you need to get on it because we uploaded just that for our $5 patrons this week. Thank you to all our wonderful new patrons, by the way. Ben Northeast. Is that a real name, Ben? I love it. It's very Kardashian. Ben Northeast. Michelle Gebby. Meg Lumsden. Jim Horn. Kat Ether. Jessica Dempsey, Jeremy Holwoods, Jeremy Holwerder, great name, Cam Densley. I mean, all the names are great. Don't think if I don't comment specifically, I don't like your name. I love them all, like my children. Tom Harper, Cassandra Badenoch, great one. So look, all names are good. That's the takeaway. And also thank you so much for becoming patrons. You can do that by going to patreon.com/austtruecrimepod, A-U-S-T, True Crime Pod. There's a $5 option and a $2 option. They are in American currency. I want you to be very, very aware of that because like dog years, it's actually more and more Australian dollars every day. Our lives are changing for the worst every moment. Just ask Kerri-Anne Kennelly. Okay, on with the show.
Please be advised this podcast contains descriptions of graphic violence and is not appropriate for children.
There was a Salvation Army hostel at the top of Auburn Road in Auburn there, and in that posh belt there. So I got to see many of those kids and that, you know. Others from the Box Hill Boys home around that area, one of them talked me into doing my first burg on a supermarket in Hawthorne. And so that began my life of crime. It stands to reason that most of us that had failed our foster and our adopted parents ended up being on the wrong side of the law, and that because we had failed our responsibilities as a foster child or an adopted child.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb.
Today on Australian True Crime, we hear from the one and only JC, Jack Charles, better known far and wide as Uncle Jack Charles. Many Australians know Jack as the charming actor and writer. His gregarious, generous nature belies a story of extraordinary courage and tenacity. Famous for many years now as an actor, writer, and subject of many, many portraits, both painted and photographic, some of you may not know about Uncle Jack's earlier years, when he was better known as a prolific cat burglar, an incorrigible heroin addict, a regular Pentridge inmate, a Box Hill Boys' Home survivor, and a stolen Aboriginal child. In the late 1990s, a young filmmaker by the name of Emile Curtin Wilson approached Jack in the street in Fitzroy in Melbourne and asked if he could follow him and film him as he went about his business. It became a decade-long process that resulted in the documentary Bastardy. By the time the film was released in 2008, Jack was heroin-free for the first time in decades. He'd completed his 22nd and last prison stretch ever, and he was writing and performing theatre again. According to Jack, that young filmmaker saved his life. Up until that fateful meeting, Uncle Jack's story was not particularly unique in Aboriginal Australia, which is no doubt part of what motivates him to keep telling it. What is unique anywhere in the world is Uncle Jack's charisma. He's a stunning entertainer, even in a small podcast studio. What's truly special about Uncle Jack is that he can tell a story about devastating unkindness inflicted upon him with unwavering warmth and generosity for his audience. It's an important part of Australian history, and he's really great at telling it. So I hope you'll encourage others to listen and to talk about it. We've taken some heat over recent months for our decision to include an acknowledgement of the traditional owners of the land on which this podcast is recorded. We've had some abusive messages and people who've told us that they'll no longer listen to the show because of it. To anyone still wondering why we feel that acknowledgement is appropriate and necessary, we offer the story of Uncle Jack Charles.
It seems like you're everywhere these days.
Yeah.
That's nice, isn't it?
I don't know who took that photo from the Monash Gallery of Art, but it's very striking. It's in black and white. And I think it's of you when you – it might be a few years old now, but, yeah, it's just very striking.
Could be Rod McNichols. He's been a portraiture photographer, and he did pick up many of us on the streets years ago. People at the Pram Factory, young actors and layabouts around the street, and took us up to the studio. It used to be a rehearsal space for us too, it's his studio now, and he took photographs of us. And those who survived, we went back up there again, you know, and I was about, about 30 when he took that first shot, and then when I turned 60, he took another shot, and he used it as a timeline series for the National Gallery of Victoria and that, you know.
I don't mean to be rude, but I wonder how many people did survive that long.
Yeah, sure. Well, no, there were a few empty frames. But that's Rod, and his photographs have been working well with me. It won the National Photographic Portraiture Prize in 2012.
Well, you got a beautiful face,
so there you go.
Uncle Jack.
Some enterprising artists down here have painted me in oils and edited me into the Archibald. And I said, it's never going to happen, you know, it's a Sydney push. And then lo and behold, Ann Doe gets me for a brush with fame. And that interview went viral. And from that painting, he asked me, would I mind him doing another portrait for the Archibald?
Yeah.
So I said, oh, this is a good thing because it's a Sydney push, I always said, the Sydney gangsters in the Arts Council, the Arts Board out there, whatever. You know, he's a Sydney artist, we'll get a leg in. It was listed amongst the three finalists, so we got a leg in. We didn't win, but we got the People's Choice. But because the People's Choice is a good three areas of the Archibald that you can look at and that, you know.
Well, you're a beloved Australian.
Yes.
But I feel like, Uncle Jack, a lot of people sort of don't really know the full story of why you're such a famous Australian. Would you mind if we begin way back at the beginning of your life, please?
Okay, good. I was born in 1943. At Royal Women's Hospital in Grattan Street, Carlton. Like most of our Melburnians, that's where we were born. Our umbilical cord was cut there. That then places me as a Melbourneite. Okay? Under the Australian system at the time, the assimilation program, all children were to be taken from their mothers, you know, shortly after birth, to be delivered into an institution to be assimilated.
Well, not all children, all Aboriginal children.
Yes, all Aboriginal children. So I was one of the ones.
Did your mum ever get to hold you or see you?
When I turned 19, about 19, I discovered where she was and found her and took a trip up there.
So she never got to hold her baby?
No, I say that in Bastardy, the documentary. I don't ever remember being held or nurtured in any way at the Box Hill Boys' Home.
What can you remember about growing up in a boys' home as a little Aboriginal child?
Well, the only Aboriginal kid there.
Okay.
It would have been seen as a failed social experiment if other Aboriginal kids had been moved in with me, registered Aboriginal kids. I have since found out that there were a couple of other Aboriginal kids there, but they didn't look Aboriginal.
Yeah.
Okay, they might have had olive complexion and that. And I look at those photographs of us at the Forgotten Australians building over in Richmond. Got these great big book of photographs of the boys from Bayswater Boys Home, Box Hill Boys Home, Burwood, and a couple of other boys' homes, so we can have a look at ourselves, you know, when we're little tykes in a baby's home or in the young children's home at 4 to 10. And then there were three sections in the Box Hill Boys Home, so I went in there as a baby after I did time at that City Mission Babies Home 2 years. It was interesting because, you know, nobody really laid into me about being black or that. I have been reminded since by some old fellas who came up and seen Bastardy and came and saw the show Jack Charles versus the Crown and reminded them that they were in Box Hill Boys Home with me. And do I remember them? Well, I don't. But they remember me. That's significant, their memories of that lone Aboriginal boy there. You know, it would have been seen, as I said earlier, a failed social experiment if other Aboriginal kids did come in.
Because
so I was there to be assimilated.
Yeah, the point of the program or the policy, assimilation policy, and what we now know as the Stolen Generation.
And those kids weren't really racist.
No,
at all.
Children.
Yeah, you know, they were kids.
Yeah.
There are some kids who came in at a later stage and in their lives, who'd been living with their mums and dads, would have learnt how to be a little bit offside with black fellas. And so I do remember having to fight a couple of kids now that it's been recalled to me, you know. Mm. Somebody came up to me one time after a show, came and saw the show, Jack Charles vs. the Crown, down in Sale, two fellas, you know, and they said, oh, Jack, we remember you well. I said, oh, sorry, fellas, that I can't remember you. I remember you chasing me around the footy oval, Jack. I said, oh, yeah, well, what were you chasing you around the footy oval for? I think I called you Blackie, Jackie. I said, oh, right, okay, so what happened? Oh, you bashed me, Jack. And so here I am 56 years later apologising to this old fella for having bashed him. But there's the beauty of being a person of renown. You know, that people from my past can come out of the blue, knock on my door, as a matter of fact, because my address is in Bastardy, the documentary, you know.
Do you still live there?
Yeah, I still live in that block.
Let's cut that out. I'm going to cut that out. No, I don't want people to know that.
Well, it's known. Everybody knows that that was the building that actually saved my life once I was housed.
Mm.
You know, once the Aboriginal Health Service gave me a unit, you know, I only ever did one more burg after that.
Well, come to the burg.
I kind of weaned myself off burglaries.
Well, this is it. But I want people to know very clearly, you know, why, how your life ended up where it ended up. That's really important.
You know, being raised in Box Hill Boys' Home, right?
And taken from your mother.
Taken from your mum, you know.
Yeah.
There were a few times in the homes that, you know, I had to even have an awakening. You know, from the age of about 10, 11, I knew that something was amiss because there was an incident up in the Blackfella camp in Griffiths during the 50s, early 50s, where my mum was charged with murdering somebody. And I believe Uncle Doug Nichols had sent in my uncle and auntie, Henry and Amy Charles, into the home to check on Blanche, as my mum's the firstborn, to check on me. And that broke the pattern of believing that I was an orphan.
For you?
Because everybody was telling me I was an orphan.
Yeah.
Even my foster mum and the Aboriginal Welfare Board was telling me I was an orphan. You know, they didn't want any signs of this incident that happened in the Blackfella camp come to light. And so there's been an element, in actual fact, from my perspective, Aboriginal payback law delivered to the Charles family. The Charles name here in Melbourne, Victoria, was Mud at the time. I tried to make contact. The second contact into Aboriginal Melbourne was difficult to make contact. So being raised up, you know, in the Box Hill Boys' Home for 12 years there, and then being fostered out to the widow Murphy and her twin bodgy sons up in Blackburn. Great experience to experience, you know, to understand what it was like living as a family member with Widow Murphy and the twin bodgy sons. It was great. And going to work straight after I left the home the day after.
Can I just ask you to confirm, though, Uncle Jack, that there was abuse in the Box Hill Boys' Home?
Oh, yes.
So you've been taken from your mother, had no maternal nurturing or anything like that as a small child. There has been abuse of every kind in the Box Hill Boys' Home. And then as a young teenager, you've been fostered. And so are you being sarcastic or are you being honest about it being a nice home that you went to?
Well, it was nice.
Okay,
you know?
Nice. It was, okay,
yes. You know, I get to look upon it with hindsight. The bodgies had a horse.
What's a bodgie?
Bodgies and wedgies. They were like the skinheads. And,
They used to fight each other, didn't they?
They had big fights in Blackburn.
Bodgies and wedgies.
The twin boys were involved in the fights too. And they allowed me to look after the horse. They were apprentice mechanics, you know.
Real suburban household.
Real suburban, yes.
Where did you work when you
I
left
worked
the
at
home?
RMS Glass in Riversdale Road, Hawthorne, as a glass beveler. So I went straight to work the day after I left the home.
Wow.
Remember, those of us that left the home, were about to leave the home, were given a heads up by the Aboriginal Welfare or the Child Protective Services to take us on a train trip from the home from Box Hill up to Blackburn, then walk us up to Tenterrill Avenue, see Mrs. Murphy. Oh, hello, Mum. I call her Mum, you know. And then, because we'd known each other for a while, her daughter plucked me when I was younger out of the home and taught me to swim at the Box Hill swimming baths, even though we had a pool in the home there too. Many families around Melbourne were doing this too. I was taken by two other different families during the time. Many of us were taken and given a trial run with a family, a weekend holiday or a part of the school holiday we were taken. As I remember, a family over in Elphington.
In this day and age, that sounds hideous.
Yes.
That sounds...
See if we were potential adoptees or foster kids.
It sounds
and
so...
And that's here we are all waiting.
Yeah.
You know, in the wings.
Like puppies.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
It sounds to
we
us.
We were like that. And of course, I was cute.
Well, you're still cute.
I was Aboriginal, you know.
Right.
No, I was cute, apparently, you know.
Yeah, because that's that colonial sort of little black babies idea, isn't it, really?
I've got the letters that Mum or Mrs. Murphy wrote to the welfare people saying that I'd like to, we've got along famously, and I'd like to actually have him live with me.
But what's the feeling when they drop you back off and don't come back, like you failed the weekend? I mean, you didn't fail, obviously.
The worst one was that after that incident up in the Blackfella camp, I can now, with hindsight, make it certain that Uncle Doug Nichols had sent in my auntie and uncle to check on me. So they took me, they came in and took me in their big car opposite to the Box Hill Boys' Home, the footy oval in the park there, the Surrey Park. And there was an old quarry that was called a Surrey Dive. It was filled with water and it was attached to the Box Hill Baths and that. So you got your bronze medallion if you can swim across. But Mrs. Murphy won the day. And, but she was always, you know, trying to convince me that I was an orphan. But I had to tell her those incidences, those quiet incidences that where I believed that I wasn't an orphan. I told her the incident that I had an uncle and auntie come in and took me on a picnic. And then just before, a month before I left the home, my first sighting of other Aboriginal kids in that home.
Gosh, what
was
did
delivered
you think?
Unto I mean, me. Kutcha Edwards and his brothers.
No.
Kutcha.
No.
So it was the only time that I've ever been taller than Kutcha.
Ah. No.
And this is the sin of it all, you know. Kutcha's mum and my mum are sisters.
No.
Yes.
Your cousin.
So we were first cousins. Oh. But in amongst those kids was this young fella, Arthur, who said his last name's Charles. And I can recall saying to him, wouldn't it be funny, mate, if we were brothers?
Yeah.
Well, we were.
Oh, wow.
We are. I buried him a couple of years ago.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes. And I buried two of those sisters. The other thing is that once I left, I still had this streak of the whitewashing had worked with me at the Box Hill Boys' Home. You know, I faithfully went to church, but I'd had to sneak out my bedroom window to go to the Methodist service in the Blackburn Village. And that just pissed Mrs. Murphy off one time. She came in and dragged me out by my ear hole.
Wow.
But I stuck fat with the church, you know, because they were great. They, you know, took me out on outings and that, you know, holidays and that, you know, weekends and to go rabbiting and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. So I learnt that. And also they delivered us up to, we had a little entertainment group and we traipsed one time up to the Nutterwadding Girls' Home, Wynne Layton, to put on a concert. And amongst all those little girls there were these two small, waif-like, Aboriginal children. And, of course, I just had to go up and ask them their names. The elder of the two shyly responds, I'm Esme, and this, my sister Eva Jo. Well, what are your last names, the girls, I say? Charles. Charles? Well, I'm a Charles too, ladies. Wouldn't it be funny if we were brothers and sisters?
Yeah?
Ironically, we were.
No. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, the system just was not allowed to tell us that we were related.
So cruel.
The same with Box Hill.
Had they been taken from your mum as well?
Yes. All of us. Oh, well, see, your mum had 13.
God.
So everyone was taken except two that died at birth.
So I read also that you once, when you were in the foster home, you took yourself off to Collingwood because you heard that Aboriginal people were there.
Yes. This was the big sin.
Yeah.
You know, what seeking happened? Out my family and that, you know, at the behest of, I wrote it in my play, the blokes at work urged me to check out Fitzroy Jack. A lot of black fellas over there. Bet you got family amongst them.
Mm.
So one Thursday night, with a full pay packet that I normally take home unopened to Mrs. Murphy, I went over to Fitzroy. And no sooner had I jumped off the tram on the corner of Napier and Gertrude Street when this old black fella pulls me up. Charles! You Blanchie Charles's boy! I shat myself, of course.
How did he know?
Just by my bone structure. My size.
Yeah.
By looks, we can tell.
Yeah, okay.
I've learnt that they can tell.
Yeah.
People can tell.
Yeah.
I know, too. I've got to know now, you know. Mm. I can't say exactly now because I've never been raised up, but this fellow was. And so he ushered me into the Builder's Arms, and, of course, I've entered another world there. Every face in the place seemed to be black. Anyone who could, they rush up to introduce themselves to me as a cousin, an auntie, an uncle. I'm so overwhelmed by their beery hugs and kisses. I didn't drink, so I dove into my pay packet, shout a few beers, and I had a lemon squash myself, you know. Your mum, she living up in Swan Hill, one old lady croaked. You should go and see her, young fella. So that hit me like a ton of bricks. So I told her I will, first chance I get. So, of course, I got back late that night to Mrs. Murphy, jumped up and down on the footpath there out there in the front door. Joy, oh, joy, Mum, I just found Mum. I expected her to share my joy, but no such luck. She wrangled the story out of me. My night in the Fitzroy pub, been recognised as a child, but worse still, my pay packet ripped open and a third of it spent. This riled to no end. She comes at me, those people will tell you anything. Yeah, well, I believe them, I say, raising my hand. Oh. Am I going to hit her? I see the fright in her eyes. Get to bed, she hisses before backing off. No sooner had I put on my pyjamas and settled down for the night when she calls me to the front door. Police divisional wagons parked in the drive and I'm driven over to Royal Park Home for Juvenile Offenders.
No.
I was a ward of the state, a child of the Crown, and would have been until I'm 18 and that woman I'd called Mum had deemed me unruly, disobedient. So for the first time, locked alone in a cell, I remember crying myself to sleep that night.
Oh,
and it's the first of what becomes for me a series of incarcerations.
Oh, Jack.
And from that time, all my Christian sensibilities were somewhat blackened.
Oh. So she jumped immediately to the stereotypes of violence and of blackfellas lying, cheating, stealing your money, yes, and you turning.
She so here's, thought, here's the other end of the scale. My first crime.
Your first crime?
My first crime.
You which see. You hadn't even committed.
Well, you know, many of us, as soon as we were taken, it was a criminal offence to be a child in need of care and attention. There are many records which have just recently been expunged of the work with Uncle Larry Walsh, and that these criminal records from the age of, you know, when you, the time you were taken, you know, I've seen evidence of other people's criminal records. One, Choco Edwards, has said at seven he was taken from his mum, and the offence was he was a child in need of care and attention. And I don't think it happened to white people. Common reflection, I understood now why the Box Hill police already knew me. I hadn't been introduced to me, nor I to them, and that. But so obviously in those days, people coming out of a borstal, being borstal boys or girls, were the local police, the authorities, were apprised of the information that where so-and-so, Mrs. Murphy, of 10 Tyrrell Avenue, has a fostered an Aboriginal child, okay? So keep your eye on that.
God, ready.
Just sounds like absolute madness when you're listening to it. And I didn't even know the full ins and outs of it, so listening to you is really helping me to understand the deep trauma that whole generations have had.
So, as far as the rapes and the abuse was concerned, I'd always put it behind me. But on that last jail sentence in 2005, a bunch of the boys from Box Hill Boys Home were all collecting our methadone. And they said, oh, Jack, do you remember us from Box Hill Boys Home? No, fellas, I don't. Oh, well, we remember you, Jack, you know. Listen, Jack, we're part of a class action against the Box Hill Boys Home and the Salvation Army. And then they mentioned a few officers' names and that opened a can of worms for me. And then I knew what they were about to say, but they said, we want your phone number, Jack. We believe that you're the best person that could give credence to our stories, validate of what went on in the Box Hill Boys Home. So I did come out. But before I came out, I had that awakening. That that moment where the penny dropped for me after having gone through the Murrumbidgee program delivered by Auntie Lorraine Peters and her daughter, it I like to say it relit the burning embers of my fucked up, locked up, drugged up, fucked up dreamings and that. It worked for me. I intended to leave the jail, to go back into Collingwood Fitzroy, proclaimed myself as the new sheriff in town, the local Featherfoot Kadacha man lawman. And I would have, I validated myself. You know, I'm a man of lived experience. Before I went in, I jumped off the smack and took up the methadone because I knew I was going to do time. So the doctor convinced me to do this one jail sentence with methadone, Jack, because you're a bit crook. You know, you might not survive it. So I did. I'd never used methadone before. I knew of its invention. I knew the full story of methadone. As a drug addict, I got to know that the Germans invented it because they couldn't find any morphine. And it's a more insidious drug to try and come off. Many of the people in those days used to get back on the smack to get off the methadone.
Still do.
So, yes.
Still do.
So it's a vicious cycle for many of them. Mm. And as I said on that, that Murramali program awoke within me. You know, that sense of pride and discovering of my empowerment. I had a voice. I'm an actor, you know.
I know.
So, you know, so I used to use my fine sense of con artistry, you know, in telling the stories when they did ring. You know, the other trick was that during that whole one-year jail sentence there, I still had the key to my unit in my property.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Property, Collingwood Office of Housing, had maintained it for the full year and a month. Normally, they deliver it to another person after 9 months, if you're still
Well,
in
the
jail.
Documentary Bastardy demonstrated for everybody that you were one of those drug users who maintained the charm. You were one of those people who was a self-confessed drug user, cat burglar, nightmare for Melbourne, you used to call yourself, rent collector was the way you described, your crimes, theft.
Yeah.
But lovable and charming.
Yes, and a charming old reprobate.
Right?
The busker, your local busker.
So it doesn't surprise me that the Department of Housing would keep your flat for an extra 3 months and that those things would happen for you. But could you take us back to, you know, where we left off was that horrible night when Mrs. Murphy sent you for your first night in custody? Because I wonder, obviously, we can see very clearly you've had a lifetime of pain as a young man, and we know that heroin abuse generally comes about from pain.
Yes.
Because it's a painkiller.
Yep, certainly was.
And also that then is the precursor to the life of crime to pay for the heroin.
The next morning I awoke to see many other kids from the home, Bayswater home, Burwood Boys home too, and Box Hill, all of us failed foster kids and adopted kids and that. And some of them were already on the life of crime.
After the break, Uncle Jack Charles catalogues his life in crime, from his very first burg to a standoff in the Pentridge exercise yard with one of our most often mentioned characters. I wonder if you can guess who it might be. Coming up on Australian True Crime, Uncle Jack takes on Collingwood's young drug dealers. But first, we travel way back to his earliest forays into the world of crime. We pick up with young Jack Charles, waking up in the Parkville Detention Centre after his first ever night in jail, having been sent there by the widow Murphy for the terrible crime of spending his own wages on a night out at the pub with other Aboriginals.
The next morning, I awoke to see many other kids from the home, Bayswater home, Burwood Boys home too, and Box Hill, all of us failed foster kids and adopted kids and that. And some of them were already on the life of crime. I was lucky my boss bailed me out.
Before she sent you there, you had a job.
You
had friends and
absolutely.
You had the horse.
But there was always that move that I would have to do to go into Collingwood Fitzroy, and that was my undoing. My boss wondered where I was. And that it was a great job. It was a great camaraderie and the social group and that. You know, we used to go to the Tivoli Theatre and all that kind of stuff.
So it was a nice life you were living.
It was a good life. Yeah. You know, I was starting to get interested in performing and all that myself and that, you know, because I used to sing a lot there. And that, as a matter of fact, the local police in Glenferrie forced me to get up and sing at Ziegfeld's 60-40 dance there in Glenferrie above the market there. Frankie Davison was the host, a 48-piece orchestra and that, and people dancing and that, and I had to enter this competition or go to jail or get charged with a crime and that. And I won. I won the competition. I went in the next week and I won it again. And if I'd have won it the third time, I would have had a spot in Graham Kennedy's in Melbourne tonight.
Wow.
But instead I was busted by the Camberwell police.
What did you get busted for?
Housebreaking. So the thing is, you know, once the door was opened to that cell over in Parkville then, I see all these other boys almost at the cusp, you know, 2 years before leaving, being a Borstal boy, a ward of the state behind. I have to make my own choices now because my boss bailed me out. He says, where's my favourite little Aboriginal worker? And that, you know, he's in jail now. He's in jail. He mucked up and that. So he came and bailed me out. I charmed him because he used to always bring his mates around to meet the little Aboriginal boy working in the factory and that. And at one time he brought around this bloke. He said, Don, Jack, I want you to meet a mate of mine. The usual opening line. I said, Elf. Don Bradman, meet Jack Charles. So I shook the hand at 15 of Don Bradman.
Wow.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable, because years later, the ABC employed me to play the part of Eddie Gilbert, the Aboriginal fast bowler who bowls Donald Bradman out twice for a duck.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. You know, anyway, the opening was the realisation of being looked after by my boss and placed into a Glenferrie's gentleman's resident, full board and all that kind of stuff, going back to work. And then meeting many others from the Box Hill Boys home around that area. There was a Salvation Army hostel at the top of Auburn Road in Auburn there, and in that posh belt there. So I got to see many of those kids and that, you know, and one of them talked me into doing my first burg on a supermarket in Hawthorne. And so that began my life of crime. It stands to reason that most of us that had failed our foster and our adopted parents ended up being on the wrong side of the law. Yeah. And that because we had failed our responsibilities as a foster child or an adopted child. It was so easy, young, impressionable minds like mine was at that time,
Also, it feels like that was the expectation, that that was what was expected of you.
Yeah. Just follow the normal pattern.
Yeah.
And then even going into Pentridge, into the Young Offenders Yard, I was given a measure of protection there because there were many Xbox Hill Boys Home boys there and gangsters, already gangsters and that, you know. And so everybody knew me and that, you know. I didn't know them, but they knew me, you know, Jackie Charles. My job in those days was to write letters for them because many of them couldn't read and write, so I was well-educated and I'd had some elocution lessons at the Box Hill Boys Home, so it was pretty weird for, you know, somebody to come in, an Aboriginal especially, to come into Yogg's Yard or into Pentridge, into the cattle yard, speaking the Queen's English better than most and that. So I was a bit of a novelty and that, and I was given a lot of respect for that. People like Chopper Reed didn't really take to me too kindly and things like that, you know. We had some words in the yards one time and that, you know. But on the other end of the scale, you know, watching these people and seeing how they matured into their practical dotage and that before Chopper died here in Collingwood, I had watched his journey and I had noted and gave a lot of respect and due him because he, you know, he did a lot of paintings and he sold out in Hogan's Gallery up there, sold out show, and every piece was, you know, quite expensive and that his paintings were childlike and all that kind of stuff, but I liked them. And I never bought one myself. Mm-hmm. It was too pricey, out of my price range. But he left a lot for his kids. And this is what we all try and strive to do. And that's so there's that other end of the scale. He hated my guts. I don't know why. I never gave him any reason to hate my guts. We were too young to be even talking to each other, you know. I remember the incident he came up. And I was speaking to a fellow named Brian O'Callaghan, and he became a very heavy gangster, that fella, the O'Callaghan boy.
Chopper comes up a lot in our podcast. It's like this recurring theme, and, yeah.
Well,
and Pentridge.
Whenever you talk about Pentridge, yeah. Did you feel like you fitted in that environment?
Oh, yes, I fitted in so well.
In a way that you would never fit in outside?
I felt needed. You know, I was writing letters on behalf of people. They were giving me their innermost thoughts. They'd come to me. It was a laugh because they'd come to me with bits and pieces cut out of the back pages of the papers, births, registrations, death notices and that, and they would want me to meld in some of the words into their love letters.
Oh, nice. Bits they liked.
Yeah, bits they liked.
Put a bit of that in.
Yeah.
So it sounds like it would be a much more comfortable environment than out here.
Well, it was a place of sanctuary. You know, you got to sleep in a bed. In those days, it was a single cell. They double up now.
Did you ever go to jail deliberately? Did you ever have any of those times?
I never minded, really. It was a way of respite, in a way. I believe that every time I was busted, I got another 5 years lease on my life. And here I am at 76 now this year because I had been given that break. It was always with a sigh of relief that I accepted being busted and I accepted to have to go through the motions of going into Paran Cop Shop and all the houses I'd robbed, and it would come to around near 7,000. And they, Jack, we can't charge you with 7,000. What about 77? Would that help? Okay, Jack? So I had these moments with the police, you know, great moments. In the old days, you know, my addictive days, you know, they couldn't get a word out of me unless they got the police doctor in to give me a shot of pethidine. Yeah, and once you have a shot of pethidine, you know, people going through birth would know this. You're very talkative. You can be very talkative.
Yes.
Warmed and flushed on pethidine.
22 convictions.
Yeah, 22 convictions, yeah. You know, this mob here, you know, our best fucking catburg, but really, 22 times incarcerated, I say, come on, fellas, it's a failed catburg.
So talk us through your criminal career. How long was it?
Oh, it was quite some time, from the age of 17 onwards.
And what made you decide to retire?
Well, it was that last, was Bastardy, the doco.
The documentary. And how did that come about? Because it's very honest and it's one of those documentaries that we watch. You're very charming in it and you're very honest, but it's a very hard life that you're living. You're living the life of an addict. And it doesn't surprise me that you feel like going to jail is respite because it's a hard old life you're living. And then when you saw that documentary, what did you feel?
I am blessed that I had a young fella that gave me a lot of respect. Mm-hmm. Not like that television show, that Channel 9, there's a show about people struggling on the streets.
Oh, you don't like that one. Struggle Street.
Yeah,
you don't like Struggle Street. Okay.
It's not like that.
Okay.
This was, you know, just follow me. He asked me, would I mind him following me around with his camera and crew recording my life on the streets? And I already said my first instance was to say, well, I'm due for a whack. Come and record that.
So a whack is when you have some heroin?
Yes. Yeah. So that was significant. I felt from that time that he asked me that it's about time, you know. Yeah. About time somebody got to hear my story. One stolen generation person's story. Yeah. That I'll run with this. We never knew. It took 2 1-year jail sentences during those 8 years of the development of Bastardy the Doco. There are a lot of trials and tribulations. We never thought I'd survived and that kind of stuff. Going into jail on the last time, they never thought I'd survive that one. But I did. And that's because I had the intention of coming out, even though I was refused parole. If I had done that 1 year jail sentence, that my parole officer, my cousin sitting on the parole board, had deemed me unsuited for parole again. This was really strange because he was my cousin. He hadn't noted the fact that I still had the key to my unit in my property, that I was going to be leaving this jail, not homeless, for the first time leaving a jail situation, not homeless, but having my own unit to go back to. Nobody had broken into or entered my unit since the time the police came and picked me up. So that's why I was assured. I knew that I had some place, but also I had the intention of coming back and striking out to be a leader in my own right in Collingwood Fitzroy. I aimed myself upon the last Kadaicha man, Featherfoot. He used to deliver his admonishments with a baseball bat and sometimes with the threat of a pistol.
When was he rattling around?
During the 70s and 80s. And he was a hard man. Any women that complained to him about their man bashing them, he'd be very hard on them. He tried to delay the intrusion of powders into Collingwood Fitzroy. Matter of fact, went up to the pram factory and wanted to bash the dealers that were hanging around the pram factory. Mm. That's where I had my first whack in the 70s, 73, I think it might have been. I had my first whack there. We were so full of it in those days, you know. I was becoming a really bad drinker. I remember doing Dimboola there, the first theatre restaurant performing piece.
Oh. Yeah.
And Bastardy there. And I was very alcoholic in those days. And there was an incident where something or other, I knifed the four tyres of a mate's car, a Singer sports job, you know, Morgan. Lovely cars, you know. I was that drunk, angry with him. I knifed his four tyres once he told me about that penny dropped then, instantly I thought I could have stabbed him. So I gave up alcohol from the time he told me. Hadn't drunk a drop for 8 years, but I took up the smack instead.
So you did, though. You got bail. You got out of jail, and for the last time, the 22nd time.
Yeah.
And you got back to your flat and it was still there and you had the key.
Yeah.
So how did you go about convincing everyone in the neighbourhood in Collingwood Fitzroy that you had changed your life?
Well, first of all, I had to jump off the methadone first. I always knew that I was still thinking awry, okay? During this period of 2 years, I was really comfortable in realising my potential and I realised I had to do a number of things. The Elders Leadership Skills course was being undertaken in those days through Canberra. I and Choco Howard Edwards from Victoria would go to these functions, the women in another convention centre and the men in another.
From this heroin addiction that you'd had for such a long time, did you feel like you were just kind of reawakening, being reborn?
Yes, but I was so busy.
You're going to feel
I was so busy actually watching me back. I was given a hard time by it because I approached the fellas that were bashing the women because people were complaining. Some girl in the walk-ups in Campbell Street said, Jack, you should give a measure of protection to this woman. She's Archie Roach's bass player at one stage down on Hard Times and that. So I went around and said, I'll stay here the weekend because they know I'm here now. They used to deal outside her unit, give her a hard time. They bashed her because and kicked her in her private places, one of the local hoods, dreaded clan, everybody dreaded and all that kind of stuff. But no. As I said earlier, I knew them, raised them, watched them grow up, protected them when they were in Pentridge at one stage. So the point was I felt that I had the right, the inherent right, to pull them up and to say the right things in protection of this woman. And they did say, "You're going against the Brotherhood, Unc." I said, no. I know what you've been doing, fellas. I know what you've been doing. You know, you've got to stop selling shit to people and also giving them used syringes.
Oh.
You're spreading what you've got around. You've got to stop that. But also you've got to stop this behaviour with this woman. If you left her alone, you know, I'll talk her into taking the charges off. But they made it life difficult for us. I had just come out of jail recently, and I hadn't known that the Neighbourhood Justice Centre was in vogue, was happening. We found ourselves trapped in that unit sometime. It's very scary. So I rang around. There was nobody in any of the services that would come to my protection. Nobody. So we rang the police.
Oh, how did that
and they
down?
Suggested, look, Jack, we know what's been happening down there, and I think it's a good thing that you've gone and delivered yourself with this woman, and you've, you know, given her protection on that. I think it's a great Jack. That's what the Collingwood Jack said. And they said, Jack, take her around to the Neighbourhood Justice Centre, work out something with them. We got around there in the Neighbourhood Justice Centre, and she laid a restraining order against this mob and that and these mercenary misses. And that, and it's upped the ante a little bit. You've got to remember, we're talking with people that are using drugs. You know, we're not using drugs, but they are.
Yeah.
So, you know, within their law, what we're doing really pisses them off.
Yeah.
They get angry. So they came at me with a knife. I'd jump off the tram on the corner of Smith Street and Johnson Street there, and I'd have to tighten the sphincter because I didn't know from when these gangsters were going to come from. Quite heady time and that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm only a little fella.
Yeah, you, look, I didn't want to mention that. But
yeah. But these are big, tall fellas, and I'm going up against them. Some small part of me says, well, I am JC.
Yeah.
I am Jack Charles. I learnt a lot about Christians, you know, JC turning the other cheek. Well, I didn't actually turn the other cheek, you know. I would round on them. If they called me a dog on the street, I'd stand on the top rung of the stool that I was sitting on to give me a little bit more height for instant street theatre along the Smith Street strip. Only a black junkie raised rat like yourself would call me a dog. To prompt, you know, a response, either that, walk away in disgust with themselves or with me, maybe come back, you know, for an apology. Took a full year for them to actually turn around and make an apology over that. But that was before some pretty heavy people had to talk to these people.
Well, your courage and your wisdom won the day.
Mm.
And you definitely, as we started this conversation, we round back.
Yeah,
we
come they're back both around. Still alive. They're both still alive now.
Well, and I'm sure they're part of the community that, you know, the community respects you greatly, and you've become a community leader. And so I know that you are very focused on young community members. Why is it that we have such high incarceration rates with young Aboriginal people in Australia, increasing rates?
Mm.
Why is it we talk so much about the stolen generation, and yet we have more Aboriginal children removed
being
from their homes
now,
today
yes.
than
I've
ever
said
before.
That recently,
right? Why is this?
It's because our own services have failed to do the right thing,
okay,
and to be genuine with the programs. They're very good at accessing money for certain projects, but it's only done half-heartedly. And that, you know, the Men's Shed program. You know, the Men's Shed program, people should be coming back from a Men's Shed program weekend up in country, coming back in order to be able to apologise to their missus, their daughters, and start thinking differently, respecting the women in our community, because there's a lot of violence still in our community. We're not at that level yet. You know, we need to reinstate our community centres again. Because of the abandonment of our workshop, our community centres, our hubs around the nations, there has been that sharp rise in numbers in our youth detention centres and adult prisons. If you want to develop more jails, cut the processes of keeping people out of jail. Cut the financing of community centres. Cut any possibility of these people gravitating towards one hub in their small town. I'm going to deliver that up in Shepparton and Maroopna one time very shortly. I've been pushing this for over 10 years to develop.
You said something really poignant when we were having a coffee just before we started recording, Uncle Jack. And you said as a member of the Stolen Generation, even at age 76, you are constantly learning about yourself. And you mentioned that you only met your dad, knew who your dad was in recent years. So we all think we're on a journey of self-discovery through life, but you truly, as a member of the Stolen Generation, are.
It's like you're meeting
your brothers, your sisters. Mm-hmm. That must feel very confusing but also intriguing at the same time.
And enlightening for me because, you know, I get to understand why it takes this long and that, you know.
So who are you? What have you found out about yourself after all this
now,
time?
I know now that I'm not a mere Koori.
Okay.
I am Wurundjeri on my father's side. The last year they found out who my father was, the Koori Heritage Trust.
Wow.
And Bunwurrung on my mum's side, which takes in the Arts Centre down St Kilda, Nepean, Point Nepean, and all the way down to Wilson's Prime Coastal Aboriginal Real Estate. Jar Jar Wurrung on my paternal side, Great Greats. And I've yet to discover a maternal side with the Briggses and Truganini and Tommy McRae, people like that, early Aboriginal history. There's more to discover. The thing is of it is that when I did come back the second time into Aboriginal Melbourne to check and try and connect, and that it was difficult a second time coming in. I become independent and well and truly left being a borstal behind. So I came in the 20s and when I was 20, you know, or something. And I came into Collingwood Fitzroy walking around in crushed yellow velvet flares with a net T-shirt and big afro and that, you know. So I was this miniature afro black fella holding the hand of a man who was wearing a caftan.
Yeah, great.
Down Gertrude Street and down Smith Street.
Very fashionable. Great.
Yeah. So I thought that was the one that kept me offside with the community. You know?
The crushed velvet flares.
And it was very hard because the aunties wouldn't tell me much when I did ask them. When our services were developed, you know, the old Aboriginal house service on the Gertrude Street strip, you know. I do remember going to that building when it was the sexual diseases clinic and to get my 10 shots for a dose of the syphilis that I got around Collingwood Fitzroy and that, you know, gallivanting there. And I remember these times and that. And so we jokingly say, yes, yeah, well, the blacks are looking for their own health service. Yeah, we'll give them that poxy building up there in Gertrude Street. You know, that'll help them.
Yeah.
And it was the beginning. Foley McGuinness developed that along with a lot of support and that Koori College and the dentist service. As a matter of fact, I was the first person to be given treatment in the dental service and that, you know. Really strange because I had a buck tooth, one of my beautiful buck teeth chipped with a police 38 that was shoved in my mouth in Paran one time and that, and it was getting sore and painful. And so I was the first recipient at the dentist clinic. The next day I had to go and audition over at Malvern on the street next to the railway line there for Apocalypse Now. The original script called for an Australian Aboriginal deserter who joins some tribe nearby that delivers messages but also drugs into Marlon Brando's cabin.
So for the film you were auditioning?
So I auditioned for that was the original script. They rewrote it and put Dennis Hopper in and that, you know. But you've got to remember, I had just been shoved out of the New Theatre at that time. I'd done my 7 years amateur work with them, and they said, it's about time that you went out. So this was one of the first. So all these was happening. Aboriginal health services were developing. I wasn't welcome in Aboriginal Melbourne.
But you always had such courage for a person who...
kept pushing the boundaries.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, being in their face and that, you know.
Yeah.
I auditioned for hair. You know, I don't audition now because after the Boney series, this convinced me that I should never, ever audition anymore. You know, don't try to audition, Jack. You'll never get any work.
Why?
You auditioned for here, you never got it. You auditioned for Apocalypse Now, you never got it. I wanted to play Boney, okay, because I went in there. John McCallum was interviewing prospective actors for it. I've read all 37 books of Arthur Upbill's in prison. I've become acquainted with this character. I wish I hadn't said in prison.
Oh, yes, of course. I didn't even notice when you said that.
That was the 1970 series, wasn't it, Boney or something?
I thought you meant the one of, like, 10 years ago where Cameron Daddo played Boney.
That was it. Yeah, that was it. Yeah, we were pissed off because he was the last person to ever black up. I thought that once Bob Mazur and I came around, they stopped blacking people up to play Aboriginals. But, of course, this is John McCallum, Googie Withers' husband.
Yes.
Still a touch of the racism in
different
him.
Different generation, and that. Yes.
And he said to me, he said, I'm sorry, Jack, we're looking for somebody with blue eyes.
No.
I got this ring of blue around there, so he wasn't really looking at me. So I was resolved from that time never to audition. So I've told my agent, listen, just tell them that Mr. Charles is too far up himself to audition. He fears rejection. Get a laugh out of it and that when you reject them.
You know what I say, Uncle Jack? I'm not going to fight for a seat at a table anymore. If I'm not invited to sit down, I'm not interested anymore. I'm not fighting for a seat at a table anymore. I'm over it. And if people should be clamouring to have you sit at
Bloody
their table,
hell, yeah.
And if they don't get that, fuck them.
Yeah.
They don't deserve you at their table if they don't get that.
Yes, well, it's a waste of time.
And to
try and convince people who just don't want to be convinced.
No, they wouldn't be charming company anyway. So there's plenty of us who want you at our table.
It makes great for writing theatre. You know, just little stories and that. You can put in stories and that. It's great. To experience these things has been a blessing.
Yes.
Because I've experienced them. With a clarity of mind that I had.
In 2015, Jack Charles was one of a number of former residents of children's homes run by the Salvation Army, who testified before the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse. He and others spoke of widespread sexual abuse and beatings perpetrated by staff members and a cycle of older children assaulting younger ones. The Victorian government admitted failing in its duty of care over children who were abused in the homes, but no charges have ever been laid. Thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime. We'll be back next week.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. ACAST.com.
Australian True Crime. The live show is coming.